Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to session W17, which is entitled Advanced Modeling and Simulation. Can it reduce the costs and transform the future? My name is Steve Bajorek. I'm from the Office of Research at the NRC, and it's my honor to welcome everyone here to this session, which I think is going to be very informative and very important to the nuclear industry. What we're going to do this afternoon is we're going to talk about a couple of things which I think is very important to the nuclear industry. And I think if you've listened to some of the other sessions, I think we all realize that the nuclear industry is kind of at a crossroads right now. We all realize that if we open some of the trade press, we hear plants considering premature closure. The economic situation is very harsh. But we also see a tremendous amount of opportunity for the nuclear industry. As we talk about global climate change and as the worldwide population increases, the need for massive amounts of clean energy. And I think a lot of us feel that the only way that's going to be addressed is if we foster the nuclear industry, replace current plants, find new ways of generation and process heat in order to satisfy those demands. So what we want to explore this afternoon is the use of computers in order to do this and advanced modeling and simulation. And I'd say that, well, the idea of using computers and advanced simulation to solve complex problems is really nothing new. This has been going on since the 50s and the 1960s. But we have a big difference now. One, we have the computing resources, and we have the talent now to really do that. So I'm honored to have four distinguished panelists here today that represent, I think, a very broad range of the nuclear industry. We're going to start off with Mark Dennis, represents EPRI and has been doing a tremendous amount of work in non-destructive engineering. He's going to talk about, some of the work that they're doing that I think will make inspections much, much more efficient and cost-efficient for the utility members. We're also going to look at some work that might be more in the area of big analytics, but how we take a large amount of data in order to better understand what are the problems and issues with a nuclear plant. Dr. Gupta from NC State is here with us today. Zeus Karutis from Westinghouse has been involved in new types of fuel and how these fuel products can benefit from advanced modeling and simulation. Perhaps bring them to market sooner and bring economic benefit to the industry. And then looking to the future, as we look at non-LWRs and perhaps even small modular reactors, work that's going on at the Department of Energy to develop advanced methods in order to analyze these plants in a lot of detail and speed them to licensing. This will be brought to us by Chris Stanek from Department of Energy. Before we go on, I'd like to thank our session coordinator, Jason Thompson. He has done a fantastic job in helping me stay organized, helping get the information from our panelists together. And with that, I'd like to open the – we'll start with Mark Dennis from EPRI. And he is the program manager for non-destructive evaluation and modeling. He has 20 years of experience developing computer models to assist utilities in the development and assessment of ultrasonic procedures for nozzle and shell weld examinations. He's been at EPRI and managed several projects and collaborated with many other organizations to improve these types of techniques. He has a bachelor and a master's degree in mechanical engineering from the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Mark, go ahead.
All right, thank you very much. So I'm going to talk about computer modeling for nozzle examinations, and hopefully you can see how this is a cost-saving technology. All right, so these are the topics we're going to go over. I'm going to give a little bit of background about ultrasonics. Then I'm going to talk about a solution to this issue that we have, the application, some of the benefits and cost savings, and just summarize. So ultrasonics is one of several non-destructive evaluation methods. So NDE, non-destructive evaluation, simply means that you like to determine the integrity of a component without actually doing damage to it. So we want to see if there's any defects or faults in a component. And we use different techniques to do that. So we're going to talk about ultrasonics. With ultrasonics, there's at least two things that you need. You need to have an instrument, and you need to have a transducer that generally has a piezoelectric crystal or a piezo composite ceramic in it. So because it's piezoelectric, when the instrument sends a voltage to the transducer, it vibrates very rapidly, and that sends a sound wave through the component that you're testing. In ultrasonics, what we do is we track the amplitude of the sound wave as it travels, and that lets us know if we have any defects or not. So I have a couple of videos here. The video down at the bottom is probably the most interesting in that this is a video of someone actually conducting a ultrasonic examination. So you'll see a person moving a transducer back and forth on a pipe, and down here you'll see what we call an A-scan. It's basically a oscilloscope. So it's just showing you the amplitude of the sound wave on the vertical and the distance traveled by the sound wave on the horizontal. So what an inspector would do is they would look at this A-scan display as they scan around a component, and from that they would determine if there's any faults in that component or not. And the little animation at the top just illustrates how sound waves works. People, you know, call them echoes because sound waves bounce off of things and come back to the probe, okay? And with this technology, you can detect flaws, you can depth size them, you can measure lengths. There's a lot of different things that you can do. All right, so this is the problem with ultrasonics. So, you know, we talk real quick about echoes. So ultrasonic examination works great as long as sound comes back to the probe. So if you send sound out somewhere and it never comes back to a receiver, and then you just don't get anything. So for, and that's essentially what the problem was for us when we were trying to develop ultrasonic techniques to do nozzle examinations. So for complex configurations such as reactor pressure vessels, steam generator, pressurizer nozzles, your ultrasonic probe angle, or the direction that you send the sound wave and where you actually put the probe, is not trivial, and it requires that you do some computer modeling or math to try to figure out where do you need to put this sensor. So these two animations that I have, the one on the left where we have a transducer, this yellow rectangle here, and you can maybe see a line, a horizontal line down at the bottom, that kind of simulates a flaw or a defect in the component. So when you see the sound wave that travels from the probe and it bounces off of this defect, in the animation on the left, you see that the sound wave travels right back to the probe. So that's great. Everything is perfect. You know, we send a sound wave out, it comes right back to the probe. That's exactly what we want. The animation on the right, though, has a defect that is at an angle. And because it's at this angle, even though the sound travels from the transducer and hits it, it bounces off and goes off to the right somewhere where we have no idea where it is. So we never get that signal. That signal never shows up on our A-scan. Okay? So we would have to figure out, well, how do we prevent that from happening? So we have a defect here that, you know, we need to try to figure out how do we get the sound back from that defect. So this is the solution. We use computer modeling. And all this is a set of analytic equations that we use that describe the nozzle geometry. And we also use some vector calculus to figure out what direction the sound is going. And that's essentially what the model is a bunch of equations. One other really important thing, though, that we did is we had to determine what are the essential flaw parameters for us to detect a flaw? Okay, so we determine these to be the nominal inspection angle, which is the angle at the flaw, or some people call it angle of attack, or different things. Also, the maximum misorientation angle. So your misorientation angle, this image down, this second image, is basically how far off axis or how far out of the plane of the flaw is your beam. Because as we saw in the previous slide, we basically want to be directly in line with our flaw. Well, if we're off a little bit, we might still get some sound back. So we need to figure out how far off can we be. And then the last thing is the maximum metal path length. So as sound travels through a component, it's going to attenuate. Even in a very UT-friendly material such as carbon steel, it's still going to, you know, decrease in amplitude. So we need to figure out what is the maximum amount of metal path or distance traveled by the sound for us to actually get the sound back. Okay, and this little animation here, which is not working here, is supposed to show you, here it is, it's supposed to show you how your amplitude of your A-scan changes as you change your skew angle. So if you look at your top image here, we basically have a almost like a nozzle geometry or a tapered surface where we set our transducer on, and we have this red rectangle here, which is our defect. So because the defect and our scan surface are not oriented the same way, we actually have to rotate the probe around to get the maximum A scan. So as you see the probe rotating around, if you look at the bottom left picture there, you'll see your A scan change in amplitude. And obviously we want the A scan with the highest amplitude, which would give us the highest probability of actually seeing a flaw. Okay, so this is just to show you how changing your skew angle helps you to figure out what's the best or optimum orientation for your probe to see a defect in a complex configuration. All right, so computer modeling. Talked a little bit about it's basically a bunch of mathematical equations, and we actually started using this in our performance demonstration program several years ago. And for those of you that don't know, we have a performance demonstration program at the EPRI Charlotte office where we have a room that's about the size of this room with different power plant component mock-ups that would maybe fill up about half of this room that people come in and they do performance demonstration testing, blind testing to figure out the necessary procedure parameters before they actually go out and do inspections in the field. One other thing, though, that we use this for is we use it as a tool for utilities and vendors in developing the best or optimum approaches to go out and do these inspections on these nozzles. All right, so this is a real brief description as to how this works. So in the upper image there, we have kind of like a 3D mesh of a nozzle geometry. And there's two different things that we generally do. We do technique design, where we're basically trying to figure out what is the optimum examination approach for this particular nozzle. Okay, so we're trying to figure out what kind of sensors we need to use and where do we need to put those sensors. And we generally do that by starting with what we call the inverse problem. So we start with the parameters at the flaw that we determine, as I mentioned earlier, basically through experiment to figure out what those need to be. And then that will tell us which sensors we need and where we need to place those. One other thing that we can do, though, which is somewhat of an extension of that, is we can also look at technique evaluation. So if a vendor or an examiner has a particular set of probes already in their library and they want to know, well, can I use these probes on this nozzle? And then we can essentially run the same model with a optimization problem where we're trying to constrain the model to only use those particular probes to only scan in certain areas. And when we do that, you can end up with something similar to this bottom contour plot here, which is basically a coverage plot. And it's a coverage plot based on the misorientation angle. So how close are you to being right in line with the flaw? And based on this image, you can figure out those areas that are most difficult for a particular technique. That also comes into that's also great for when you want to do sample design. So if you're trying to figure out, you know, where do I need to put the flaws in my sample to make a difficult test for somebody, and you can do something like this to figure out where you need to put those flaws at. All right, so this is just kind of like a step-by-step short illustration as to how we use the model. So the first thing we would do is we would use the model. So we would postulate a flaw and then use the model to figure out where do we need to put the probe. And that's in the far left image. And then in the middle photograph there, you see us with a transducer. This is actually a phased array transducer that generates images of different A-scans. So we actually put the probe on the nozzle, and in the far right, you can see the flaw response that we get. So we got an image here because we're using a phased array probe, and then you also see on the left, we got our A-scan. So this is kind of a way where you can see where the model says, put this probe here with these angles, and then you can look and see what kind of response that you get. All right, so some of the benefits. I already talked about the first one, sample design. It also really helps you to reduce the number of mock-ups that you have to build. And these mock-ups are usually very expensive. The second bullet is actually probably one of the things that we started with is fingerprinting. So, you know, we would get mock-ups made, and now we have to figure out, well, how can we verify or do fingerprinting that these defects are where they need to be? Well, we use this model to tell us where to put the probe, and then that'll tell us you know, where the flaws are. It also extends the applicability of procedures and eliminates the need of building one-of-a-kind samples. You know, so you can basically extend a qualification. All right, so let's talk a little bit about numbers. So in general, these mock-ups, on which, you know, these nozzle mock-ups are really big. They can cost anywhere from $100,000 to $1 million and take a long time to build. The EPRI computer models that we've been using, we've used those over probably 300 nozzles, and that's probably somewhat of a low number. And we just estimated that we probably saved the industry at least $200,000 per nozzle in the cost of not building a nozzle and not doing all of the additional things that you would have to do when you build one. And that last bullet, just about all of the U.S. utilities and several outside of the U.S. have used our computer modeling. All right, so just to summarize, EPRI has developed mathematical models to assist inspectors in conducting examinations of nozzles and used it for design of different mock-ups. The nozzle modeling defines the examination parameters required, the probe skew, scan surface, radial position, metal path, to get adequate coverage of the examination volume. And the inputs to the model were actually developed through experiment. So all of the inputs that we use, we actually did experiments on the nozzles that we had and figured out what were the ranges of these inputs, and then we used that in the model. And as I mentioned, these models have saved the industry millions of dollars over the past several years. Thank you very much.
Mark, thank you very much. That was very interesting.
And I would encourage the audience that if you have questions to please write those down on the cards, and our volunteers will collect those, and we'll be answering questions at the very end of the program here. Our next speaker is Mr. Zeese Carudas. Zeese is the chief engineer in the Nuclear Fuel Division at Westinghouse. He has about 41 years of experience in Westinghouse, most of which is in the area of thermohydraulics, doing critical heat flux testing, development of new fuel products, CFD analysis, and most recently in the area of accident-tolerant fuels development. He's also been the overall challenge problem integrator for the DOE Castle Nuclear Hub. And I'd like to welcome Zeese. All yours.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the advanced modeling and simulation tools that we're using at Westinghouse. First, I want to talk a little bit about the approach that, you know, how we're using these advanced simulation tools. And we're definitely leveraging quite a bit from the tools that are being developed by Castle and also NEAMS. And, you know, recently we've been involved with accident-tolerant fuel, so we've put a lot of focus on using some of these tools for ATF also. I'll talk a little bit about the use of the Bison Code, which is a fuel route performance tool, the Vera package from Castle for core applications for RIA and DMB, and also application for CRUD, and then talk a little bit about CFD. The basic approach that we're using is, you know, right now our current tools, they're the licensed tools that we use for LWR applications. They're very fast, and we don't want to change these. They help in the reload process. But what we're doing is starting to benchmark these tools to the advanced modeling and simulation tools, and we're beginning to see some significant benefits. We're also beginning to use some of the advanced tools for risk assessment. A lot of the risk assessment is not for licensed applications, and we're looking at margin quantification, cost reductions, and these are some of the challenge problems we have. CRUD, PCI, LOCA, RIA, grit rod fretting, DMB, and more recently accident-tolerant fuel, and also going to higher burn-up above 62,000. And we're also beginning to utilize these tools for informing the testing that's needed for validation. And then the final area is the use of these advanced tools for micro and advanced reactors. This is the Castle, and there's some tools here from NEAMS, is the package that we're using. We're using MPACT, SHIFT, Origin for the neutronics. We're using Cobra TF with thermohydraulics, for chemistry or CRUD, Mamba, and for fuel out performance, the Bison. And there are tools all around this that help do the meshing and solving the equations. And we have an input package, peer review, to put together the input and also look at the results. And we have system codes, which are also connected, and CFD tools, which can be connected to the package. One area that we're beginning to use these tools now is accident-tolerant fuel. And in Westinghouse, for advanced cladding, we have chromium-coated zirconium, and this helps increase safety and operational margin and can enable high burn-up. Silicon carbide cladding, which is kind of like the ultimate cladding material for safety and operational benefits. And then for the fuel part, we have dope pellets, which we call ADOPT. And this is benefits to the fuel cycle costs and flexible power operation. And then for accident-tolerant fuel for the pellet, we're also looking at uranium silicide. And this has much higher density, about 17% density of uranium, and also has an improvement in thermoconductivity about four or five times. So these are the materials that we're looking at, and we need good tools to assess what the benefits are. We put together a table that kind of summarizes all the benefits that we're getting from accident-tolerant fuel. And you can see that some of these materials, you know, have some benefit. Some of them have more benefit, which are in green. And so we'll be applying these tools to these benefits to try to quantify what they are. One of the key tools for fuel art performance of the Bison Code, and this is something that's been developed at Idaho National Labs and also used heavily by NEAMS, and we're using this tool for providing predictions of expected fuel and cladding behaviors in advance of measurement data to inform design decisions. We're also looking at the potential performance issues that we could have with fuel art performance. We're looking at the performance thresholds or the cliffs in these ATF materials. And now recently we're beginning to look at PCI and flexible plane operation with Bison, and also going to higher burnup above 62,000. This is just an example of some of the calculations that we do where we're predicting the fuel centerline temperature with Bison for UO2 compared to uranium silicide. And uranium silicide has a higher thermal conductivity, and so the temperature is lower. The other area that we're looking at is we're using the Vera core package, and we're actually setting up the tool for looking at a core design, and so looking at the entire core. And we're looking at the loading pattern that you would get. We're looking at fuel cycle economics. We're looking at going 24-month cycles, going to high burn-up, applying the code for reactivity insertion accidents. And so what we're trying to do is establish what is the fuel cycle benefit for the ATF materials. This is just some examples that we've used the Vera core package for some, past core designs. This is for the AP1000 core, and the AP1000 plants from China. we've started up all four plants, and we've made comparisons to the Vera core package to the startup predictions for hot zero power and hot full power calculations, and we're getting very close comparisons in terms of boron, isothermal temperature coefficient, and rod worth. And this is better than our current tools, so we're utilizing this to help benchmark some of our current tools in terms of making improvements. We've also applied the tools to Watts Bar, Unit 2, startup, and this is measured minus predicted soluble boron. And during power ascension, we've got good comparisons there. We've also compared to the vanadium detector responses, and we've got small differences. Again, this is being used to help benchmark our current tools. The other area that we're looking at is Vera applications for reactivity insertion accident and DNB. For RA transients, especially for the uranium silicide pellet, it has an improvement in thermal conductivity, but it also has a lower melt temperature. So we need to look at that in terms of RIA and look at the different scenarios and how it performs. We've also looked at DNB for a steamline break transient with the Vera code package, and we've had very good calculations there. Just to give you some examples, we applied the Vera package for the AP1000 plant for PWR rod ejection. And this is a model that models every single rod in the core. We couple the impact code, which is the neutronics piece, to Cobra TF, and we'll model every single subchannel in the core. And then we do a rod ejection. And so it's a very detailed calculation, and it's very stable. And it worked very well. We've also applied it for steamline break, and we did it for two different conditions, a high flow case and a low flow case. The low flow case can be very expensive, very time consuming to do, we were able to show that the high flow case is more limiting, which allows us to save doing these low flow cases for streamline break. And so this was very helpful. The other area that we're looking at is CRUD, and this is a coupling of MPACT, COBRA TF, and the Mamba code as part of the Vera suite of codes. And we've applied this to several plants now, and we get very detailed calculations of the CRUD that's deposited on all the rods in the core. And this helps us understand the CRUD-induced power shift and also CRUD-induced localized corrosion that could occur in the rods. And now recently we're going to start doing some calculations for a core for accident-tolerant fuel. And for accident-tolerant fuel, if you have coated cladding with chromium or you have silicon carbide, your surface is different, so you could have a different CRUD deposition. So we're very interested to see how that would perform with different ATF materials. The other area that we're working on is CFD calculations, and this is mainly using the STAR CCM Plus code. And we've been looking at the fuel bundles, the reactor vessel, steam generators. We looked at reactor coolant pumps for the AP1000, and also the fuel rod bundles. One area that that we're trying to do is we know DMB testing is very expensive. It can cost like about $1 million a test, maybe even more. And so we're trying to do a virtual DMB test on a high-performance computer. Typical DMB test is about 100 points, so with different flow regimes. And we're actually applying the code and comparing to the test data that we get. And we're going to do this for different spacer grid designs to help validate this approach. So the hope is that we'll have a tool to be able to predict DNB and maybe improve spacer grid designs. The other area is doing reactor vessel type models. And we've done this for WattsBar Unit 1. You know, typically we would start with the drawings for the whole reactor core. We developed a 3D CAD model. We look at the CFD domain. We do the meshing, and then we get results. And with this, we've been looking at various problems to study the thermohydraulics, neutronics, streamline break, fibrous debris blockage. You know, you can do many different problems once you have a model like this. One area we've been looking at is the inlet flow distribution that you can get in the core and the mixing that you have in the lower plenum, and calculate all the cross flows. What happens if you have asymmetric operation with the four coolant pumps, and how that impacts your calculations in the core. So in summary, what we're doing is we're using advanced modeling simulation tools for risk assessment, which will allow more aggressive core designs and maybe more flexibility for plant operation. You know, primarily we're looking at CRUD and PCI. And for accident-tolerant fuel, we begin to use these calculations a lot more, and we're benchmarking our current tools to the advanced tools. And, of course, you need data to validate this. And we're utilizing the tools to inform testing, either for DMB tests or for tests for accident-tolerant fuel type test reactor tests. And then, we'll eventually begin to use these tools for microreactors and advanced reactors. And there, we will have to submit these tools, to be licensed with the NRC. Thank you.
Our last speaker today is Dr. Chris Stanek. Chris is the National Technical Director for the U.S. Department of Energy Advanced Modeling and Simulation Program, also known as NEEMS, and was previously the focus area lead of Materials Performance Optimization in CASEL. He received his bachelor's in materials science and engineering at Cornell University, where he was a Macmillan scholar, and his PhD in materials from Imperial College London. Dr. Stanek has published well over 100 papers related to advanced materials for nuclear energy. Chris?
Thank you very much, Steve. I thought I might begin doing something a bit radical, which is actually trying to address head-on the question posed by the title of the session itself, which to me is rather daunting. The question that Steve has posed to us is, advanced modeling and simulation, can it reduce costs and transform the future? That's something in my day job that I find myself trying to tamp down some of the hype around advanced modeling and simulation and avoid that question somewhat like the plague. However, when serving on a panel like this, we can't hide from it. It might not be a great answer, but the answer I'll give you right now is that the Department of Energy is investing very heavily in the program that I lead, the NEAMS program, to make sure that the answer to that question is absolutely yes. And so we're working very hard on advanced modeling and simulation and trying to do exactly what the title of this session is questioning us with. And so in the few slides that I have, I'd like to give an overview of the program that we're working on and some examples maybe where costs are being reduced already, but also looking down the road to non-LWR advanced reactors, where the use of advanced modeling and simulation perhaps can become even more important. So let me start with just a very quick one-slide overview of the NEAMS program. So we are a multi-lab team that aims to develop and deploy predictive computer models for the design analysis of advanced reactors primarily. We have a number of core competency areas. These are not unfamiliar to all of you, I'm sure. But we work in the areas of multi-scale fuel performance, structural materials degradation. We work in the area of reactor physics, thermal hydraulics, multiphysics, and workflow management. And you can see there that there are a number of codes listed. I won't, in the interest of time, go through all of those. Some of which you've already heard in previous presentations. But suffice it to say that we are working very closely with industry to drive the requirements of these codes for the various advanced reactor types. And so in each one of those core competency areas, we're working specifically on capabilities that will address all advanced reactor types. Let me say a few words about when we talk about advanced modeling and simulation, what it is that we mean. It's a buzzword that I'd like to spend a few moments defining. And I might define it with a few additional buzzwords. But when we think about advanced modeling and simulation, we often think about multi-scale and or multi-physics. But the reason for doing multi-scale and multi-physics calculations, at least in our mind, is to be ultimately predictive. We want to use enhanced mechanistic insight to make predictions, especially in areas of where we're data poor. Let me dispel a myth right now as well, that often I hear that advanced modeling and simulation is intended to replace experiments, and that's absolutely not what we're in the business of trying to do. And in fact, the preferred use, and I think from the perspective of our program, of the tools we're developing, is really in concert with innovative experiments to really solve hard problems. And solve those hard problems in a way that allows for more efficient deployment of advanced technologies and advanced reactors, or ultimately coming up with a better answer, a more robust or deeper understanding than if advanced MontSim wasn't used in the first place. So let me quickly provide just two examples of where we've already, let's say, experienced reduced cost. And the first one is not an original idea. It's not necessarily something that the NEAMS program is has developed itself, but it's an area in which we work. And so the use of CFD is to design spacer grids, or at least down select designs that then our experiments are performed on is an area of reduced cost. The examples on the left here are simulations using the NEC 5000 code of a 5x5 spacer grid. And this is compared to experiments performed at Texas A&M, and I see Professor Hassan sitting in the front row, whose group performed these experiments. But these types of experiments, as Zeese mentioned in his presentation, are rather expensive, ranging from hundreds of thousands of dollars to millions of dollars. And so the CFD calculations that are done to reduce the number of grid designs that are considered in these types of experiments is an obvious cost savings. Another example of reduced cost is in the area of accident-tolerant fuel. And so in this case, what we're showing is that an accident-tolerant fuel design for which there is no experimental data, especially in the areas of fission gas release. And so in this case, we've employed multi-scale modeling, which is the image on the left, to predict the fission gas diffusion. And here what you can see is that the we're confident in the models that are being applied because we have quantitative agreement with our atomic scale models for UO2, for which we have many, many years of experimental data. That's the black curve, if I can see that far. Compared to a different fuel for which we have no experimental data. And you can see as a function of temperature some key differences that will ultimately lead to different fuel performance behavior. And we've taken that information and translated it into our engineering scale finite element code, BISON, and started to perform engineering analysis of this accident-tolerant fuel and compared it to UO2. And doing this before doing irradiation tests. And we're starting to predict key performance differences between existing fuel and an accident-tolerant fuel. And so the idea here is that this sort of insight will allow for perhaps fewer irradiation tests or more targeted irradiation tests. Now, those two examples were for LWRs. But where our program is really focused is in advanced reactors. And I apologize that there are a lot of words on this slide, but these are some important points that we wanted to make sure got across very clearly. In advanced reactors, there is not the same, obviously, the same amount of experimental data that exists for LWRs. And so the same foundation for advanced reactors simply doesn't exist. And so if advanced reactors are going to be efficiently deployed, it's absolutely critical that advanced modeling and simulation, predictive modeling and simulation, play a very significant role. In addition to that lack of experimental data, the nature of the advanced reactor designs that are being pursued are highly interdependent. They really rely on multi-physics feedback in a way that doesn't quite exist for LWRs. And so having the ability to capture the interdependence of neutronics, fuel response, and thermal fluids is absolutely vital. So those two aspects, I would argue, really create a great opportunity for advanced modeling and simulation to play a very important role in advanced reactors. And those two areas are the absence of experimental data and the inherent multiphysics nature of advanced reactors. Let me make one more point, which is that in addition to the advanced modeling and simulation tools being multi-scale and multi-physics, we're starting to learn that the flexibility of the tools is also very important. And what I mean by that is we usually think about our tools as being three-dimensional, extremely high resolution. The example I just gave was going all the way down to atomistic scale. But ideally, that same set of tools can be able to perform lower resolution calculations for example, scoping studies. And we've seen recently vendors even starting to create their own scaled-down versions of some of these codes in order to rapidly assess some of their advanced reactor designs. And so having that flexibility with the same tool set where the engineers and reactor designers are able to perform very high-resolution calculations where need be, but also do a vast number of quick scoping studies with the same tool, not having to learn two separate tools, is something that we're learning to be very important. And so let me conclude by saying that our program, the NEEMS program, is very committed to working with the NRC as well as the advanced reactor vendors to assist in the accelerated deployment of advanced reactors. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris, and thanks to all of our panelists for their excellent presentations. We have roughly 20, 25 minutes now that I'd like to use for questions and answers. So I'd encourage you, if you have questions for any of our panelists, please get them to one of the volunteers. They'll bring them up. Or if you want to really confront someone, there's microphones out there as well. We'll start off. I know we have several of them. I'd like to give Dr. Gupta an opportunity first because he's got a few of these blue cards.
Well, thank you, Steve. I really appreciate the chance to come and talk here. So thank you for asking us to be able to present what we're doing. And thank you for the interest on the part of the audience. But let me respond to some of these questions, which I'm trying to group together instead of reading every question out here. Let's start with the codes that we're using. Clearly, in order to develop a true NAMAC, what we really need is we need an actual reactor, and then we need a plant simulator to be run as a digital twin. We don't have a plant. So what we are working on is we are using EBR2 and SASIS as our so-called virtual plant. So the data we are using is from the past experience of EBR2, and then we're using Gothic, thanks to Zachary, who have a wonderful tool called Gothic that we're using as our simulator. What we are using in addressing another question here is absolutely what you are suggesting, that we're using simulations to actually train our digital twin as well as train our AI routines. So we're running a lot of simulation beforehand, prior to the event, based on postulated and anticipated events that can occur, to train our AI routines so that it becomes easier to make those, I mean, not only benchmark the situations, but also to make decisions in a very timely manner. Those are the biggest computational challenges that we are trying to address at this point. In terms of one of the things is how do we benchmark or establish the accuracy of what we are doing? One of the things is that, think about it, we have a plant, we have a so-called plant simulator that we're using and training our AI routines. The first step for us is, as a benchmark, take a case which there is past data, and if there is an experimental case of an accident scenario for which there are even operator actions defined, our NAMAC should be able to completely replicate those operator actions as the very first case. So we are really breaking down the problem into smaller pieces, saying NAMAC should be able to really reproduce what an operator would do before getting into the domain where there are scenarios. The next step we would address is scenarios that operators would find not as one of the straightforward answers or one of the given operating procedure answers, but rather one of those situations where it is not a clear-cut answer available. And can NAMAC be able to address what the right actions would be under that situation? So breaking down the process into these step-by-step rules is what would help us gain confidence ourselves in developing an approach like that. Not only reaching the right solutions, but also reaching them in a timely manner. So that's one thing. And let me now address two questions here. One is on the time scale. When do we expect to do this? And are we doing any cost-benefit analysis? This project is just a first proof of concept. So if we can even take a very limited number of accident scenarios and show two things. One is NAMAC able to reproduce the operator actions? Secondly, in another situation where operator did not clearly have a very straightforward steps to follow, can NAMAC produce the steps that would be the right steps to follow? And can it do it in an appropriate time, in a real-time situation? Those would be our goals to achieve in this first so-called 2.5 to 3 month time period for which we have the project right now. Clearly, it will have to be built upon after that. As for the techno-economic analysis, ARPA-E has a very unique way to work. They do have this techno-economic analysis team, which will assist us in doing the cost-benefit analysis at some point, particularly towards the end of the project. So it's really the part of that team from ARPA-E which will help us in doing that. We are not doing that directly. Two things about operators here in terms of questions. Are we going in such a heavy machine-based environment for operators? How are we going to keep them actively involved? And can operators, is it appropriate to have operators over-rely? What about if operators are over-relying on the system? I would say those are extremely good questions and some things that we will have to address going forward once we reach that point. At this point, where we are is we want to reach a point where we can say, yes, there are scenarios which are difficult under normal operating situations right now or under normal operator training to be able to identify and have faith in those actions that one may take. Can operator be assisted with the appropriate options? Can we reach that point? Once we are there, then yes, we will have to build on that and address these points about keeping operator actively involved as well as not overly relying, identifying when the reliance is not beyond what is needed. Those are things that clearly we are not addressing at this point. We want to first reach a point where we know that we will be able to help identify scenarios that otherwise are very challenging to get. So hopefully that has answered all these questions, but I can reach out later and answer afterwards. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Zeus, I think you have one there too.
Yeah, I think the question here is related. Did we do a severe accident analysis and look at plant type benefits for ATF? And the answer is yes. We have run the MAP code. This is EPRI's code to evaluate the benefit of ATF materials in a severe accident. Typically, this would be like a station blackout, where you lose off-site power and no power from the diesel generators, and in a severe accident. And the kind of benefits that we're seeing with the ATF materials is typically one to three hours in coping time benefit. It's not a lot, but those 1 to 3 hours to an operator is worth quite a bit. And we have visited various sites and discussed with the sites what kind of benefits could you get with this coping time benefit. And there are some. And we've been looking at, benefits related to 50.69, possible reduction in surveillances, increased time to start a diesel, and reduce dose to the site with some of these ATF materials. And of course, there are a lot of other benefits associated in design basis analysis, and we've been evaluating those too. Another thing that we're doing is not just counting on these codes like the MAP code and maybe MELCOR, but also running some tests at ultra high temperature to see how these materials really perform. And we're running some tests in our labs in Westinghouse. It's an ultra high temperature test facility, just a single rod specimen with the ATF materials. And then also we're trying to run some tests at KIT in Europe, where they're modeling a severe accident test for current materials, coated cladding materials, and silicon carbide, and to try to generate all the data that you would use in some of these codes like the MAP code and MELCOR. And I don't know, maybe if you want to comment a little bit about MELCOR. I know a lot of calculations have been done in the labs, too.
Yeah, that's certainly true. It's probably not appropriate for me to comment on that. Severe accidents is an area we haven't either in the CASEL or the NEAMS program done much work in. That's been, the MELCOR work, as I understand, has been largely funded by the NRC at the national labs. It's an area where we're talking about in the future of having a more active collaboration.
All right, thank you. I've got a question for Mark. And before you go to that one, because I kind of have a related one, maybe you can help clarify. I'm not a materials or a inspection, do that type of NDE type of work. But how many, for a utility or for a plant, how many nozzles have to be tested? Is this something that's done on a routine basis? Do you have to do this on a plant-by-plant basis? You gave us some costs, $200 to $1 million per nozzle, but not clear to me how widespread that is across the industry.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll take a stab at it. Some of the cost numbers, I'm sure, would vary by plant, depending on what they have to do for a particular outage, who their vendor is. There could be a lot of things. But typically there's several nozzles that you would have to inspect. You have several RPV nozzles, pressurizer nozzles, and steam generator nozzles. So it could be five or six easy in one outage that somebody might have to inspect. As far as the cost of those inspections, I'm not really sure. That would probably vary too, depending on the vendor, where it's located, things like that. So I wouldn't necessarily have an answer to that. I did receive a question here about piezoelectric sensors, and the question, or one of the questions, is what frequency ranges do people generally use? So typically for these kind of inspections, so all of these different nozzles that I talked about today are made of carbon steel, which is very UT friendly, so we can generally use higher frequency transducers for those kind of materials. So people generally use 2.25 to 5 megahertz pro frequencies with transverse waves. So that's pretty standard. I also received a related question. How thick of a specimen does, UT work okay, or at least this particular application? So most of the nozzles are, I think, between about 6 and 12 inches in thickness. I know the BWRs would be thinner for the RPVs than the PWRs would be. So it could be anywhere from 6 to 12 inches in thickness. Certainly, it can work on something thinner than that. It just kind of depends on your geometry that you have. Anything
else? Okay, thank you very much. If we have any more blue cards, I'd be happy to collect those. If not, we can move on to my questions. Oh, good. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I didn't know you had questions. Maybe yours would be better. I'll go anyway.
Go ahead.
I'm in nuclear design at TerraPower. So we've been doing a lot of core design, things like that, and the advanced tools that you guys are working on are showing a lot of really exciting things along those lines. I'm wondering, from a plant maintenance perspective, has anyone looked into like a real plant simulator, as in, you know, this equipment needs to go down for maintenance, and so we should get two of them so you don't have to do it during an outage or something like that? Because when we're designing an advanced reactor, you know, I never designed a reactor before, like one that's been built, of course. So it's hard to figure out how to set it up, how to do a design in a way that's going to have low maintenance costs. Is that something that anyone's looking at? It might be interesting to try to look at existing plants and try to simulate the whole environment. I don't know if that's been thought about.
Okay, who wants it?
I'll take a shot. That's a visionary scenario. We hope that we will reach there, and particularly myself. I have had my feet both on the risk side, beginning in the nuclear engineering side as well as the structural mechanics side. And one of the big disconnect we see is that when you're talking things like that, you need to really integrate different disciplines, because there are completely different set of people dealing with that pump and its flaws versus people looking at the impact of any flaws there on different. There are completely even different types of sensors by two different teams dealing with that scenario. And that lateral interaction, that horizontal interaction between the individual silos, is extremely important in this futuristic designs that needs to be established. And that's what we as researchers hope that we would be able to do that. Simpler scenario being, we can do all kind of thermal hydraulic calculations just postulating breaks, and in reality there is never going to be a break, but rather a leak that it starts with, and then you start figuring out, okay, where the leak is. But if you could detect way before where the leak is about to happen, then you can essentially take actions that you don't have to deal with the leak at all well before anything like that. So it has to be a combination of different technologies that would potentially allow us to reach that place, but that's a good goal to have, in my opinion.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. I've got one, and this is probably for either Chris or Zeiss. I think it might have been at a RIC session last year or the year before. I can't remember, but one of the fuels experts said that if you really look at the development cycle for a new fuel product, you're looking at a time period of on the order of, I think it was 25 years. With these advanced tools, how can that be cut short? And do you have an estimate? Can it be taken from 25 years to what?
I can try to answer that one. It's a good one. It's a great question. I think that... with these advanced tools, I think you can reduce it, but maybe you could also do it in steps. For example, maybe you don't go for the full benefits of the materials. You try to demonstrate equivalency of what you have for current fuel with a new material, and you get it in the core first, and then you go into a second step where you have more time and you gather more data together with the application of the advanced tools to justify the benefits of the second step. So, and, you know, I look at it as almost like a two-step process, possibly. But you try to leverage the advanced tools as much as you can.
It is a really good question, Steve. And we're certainly seeing a lot of energy around the concept of accelerated fuel qualification. It's certainly something that certain fuel vendors are very interested in. And having very tightly coupled experiments with a range of multi-scale modeling and having that be an integrated feedback loop, I think to a lot of us starts to seem like the right answer. And I think time will tell what that acceleration factor will be. But it must be I can't see how it's not going to be faster than 25 years with the new tools. What it actually is, I think time will tell.
All right. Thank you very much. Do we have any additional questions from our audience? Okay.
I have a question about the NEEMS program. The advanced reactors incorporate new fluids like sodium, lead, molten salt. Are the physical properties included in the NEEMS program, or are they being developed on a case basis? And are the chemical reactions new phenomena involved in these advanced reactors part of the NEEMS program?
Yes, it's a good question. So let me be very clear that the NEEMS program does not fund experiments, and so we don't have the ability to do experiments. However, the physical properties of the coolant or the fuel, in the case of the molten salt reactors, are something that we are studying with great effort, and in particular, the area of chemistry of molten salts is an area that's been identified by some of my colleagues on the panel as a vacancy. And so that's something we're working very hard to address right now.
Thank you, Chris. Go ahead.
Question. So this is more generic question for all the folks here on the panel, including yourself, Steve. We're talking advanced modeling simulations, and even I don't know the answer, but historically the way we have worked is we've taken these simulation tools and benchmarked them. And then we license them based on the benchmarking. Looking forward, we're going to have these simulation tools, especially for projects we're doing, digital twins, where simulation tools will be very fine-tuned with the performance history of the plants. And because every plant, even for your fuel, I mean, two identical plants, fuel performance is very different in two identical plants. So if you're taking your simulation tools, the same simulation tool will only predict you one situation, but if you're tuning it based on the data collected from each plant, your simulation tools and its uncertainties will change. And so in that event, any changes to the simulation tool will now start violating the benchmarks that it was licensed against. But this is a reality that we all have to overcome somehow in the future in order to be able to allow those changes to make effective decisions. And I don't know what the answer is, but that question has persisted in my mind, how we're going to deal with it.
Yeah, I think, one of the things that we often do is parametric studies, and also looking at different uncertainties and parameters. How, when you change this parameter, how does that impact other things? So my answer would probably be to try to do as many of those as makes sense, and maybe try to capture those results so that you can maybe have an idea as to some of these different changes, how that might impact those models.
Yeah, if you can.
Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
Hi, this is Tina Bach of General Atomics. Actually, I think the conversation up here has been terrific, and there are a couple new things that I see, which I like this idea of the low-res, high-res simulation, and also from Chris, and then Zeus, you mentioned the kind of two-phase approach. I think I want to ask about another part, which is I see the modeling simulation, and in particular where I'm going here is how people use the word benchmark. So, you know, there is modeling and simulation, which is at the micro scale, the mesoscale, and then the macro or integrated scale. And I think that's important for people to understand that when we talk about these comparisons of experiments with simulations and modeling, there are different regimes and different things that you're focusing on measuring. And so the benchmark word can be used with respect to benchmarking of all the empirical data from the last 30 years. That's one way to talk about a benchmark, but that really means that you're trying to look and see if the model is predicting what has empirically been measured. I think the more important benchmarking is when you have a model which is physics-based, and you're benchmarking in two different ways. One is the simulation model is actually correct. You have the right expression of, you know, whatever crystalline fuel, you know, structure you have in there, and you're calculating fission gas release. And also validation in some sense, which is you've got a bunch of complicated numerical algorithms, and they can not converge. That's not going to work either. So I just wanted to mention that I think there are those different ways that benchmarking needs to be looked at, and we should be clear as a community to make sure we're understanding which one's being applied, because they're not all the same, and they're all challenging and hard. So I'm just wondering if anyone has a comment about that, because I think the word gets used in multiple ways, and then it gets confusing maybe to the community.
All right, thank you very much. Yeah, just to kind of add to that and, you know, maybe a comment along those lines for benchmarks, one of the things that we've found have been valuable has been participation in benchmark studies, but when there are blind benchmark studies. We often do a very good job if we take the existing data, take our tool, and predict it. A much more challenging situation is when you use that tool, the code, the method, and use that to try to predict the test before the data and the results have been released. It can be a very humbling experience for the code developers, but it's very valuable in learning what works and what doesn't work. I'll have time for one last final question if there's any out there. And not seeing anybody going to the microphone, what I'd ask you to do is to give a round of applause for our panelists. Thank them for a really outstanding